He worked the ridges and the rocky ground on the south bank first. For 10 days he climbed and descended the rugged rim of the basin, hard going against the grain of the natural geological formations, and at the end of that time he was lean as a greyhound, arms and face burned to the colour of a new loaf by the sun, and with a dark, crisp pelt of beard covering his jaw. The legs of his pants were tattered by the coarse, razor-edged grass and by the clumps of aptly named waiterbit thorns that grabbed at him to delay his progress. There was a rich treasure of bird life in the basin. Even in the heated hush of midday, the air rang with their cries, the fluting, mournful whistle of the wood dove, or the high-piping chant of a white-headed fish-eagle circling high overhead. In the early morning, and again in the cool of the evening, the bush came alive with a jewelled flash of feathers, the scarlet breast of the impossibly beautiful Nerina Trogon, named long ago for a Hottentot beauty by one of the old travellers. The metallic flash of a sunbird as it hovered over the pearly, fragrant flowers of a buffalo creeper. The little speckled woodpeckers tapping furiously with heads capped in cardinal red. And in the reeds by the river, the ebony sheen of the long, floating tail feathers of the Sakabula bird. All this helped to lighten the long, weary hours of Mark's search, and 100 times a day he paused, enchanted, to watch for a few precious moments. However, of the larger animals he saw very little, although their sign was there. The big shiny pellets of kudu dung scattered along their secret pathways through the forest, the dried feces of a leopard furry with baboon hair from its kill, the huge midden of a white rhinoceros, a mountain of scattered dung accumulated over the years as the strange animal returned to the same place daily to defecate. Pausing beside the rhinoceros midden, Mark grinned as he remembered one of the old man's stories, the one that explained why the rhinoceros was so fearful of the porcupine and why he always scattered his own dung. Once, long ago, he had borrowed from the porcupine a quill to sew up the tear in his skin caused by a red-tipped mimosa thorn. When the job was done, the rhinoceros had held the quill between his teeth as he admired his handiwork. But by accident, he swallowed the quill. Now, of course, he runs away to avoid having to face the porcupine's recriminations, and he sifts each load that he drops to try and recover the missing quill. The old man had 100 yarns like that one to delight a small boy, and Mark felt close to him again, his determination to find his grave strengthened as he shifted the rifle to his other shoulder and turned once more to the rocky ridge of the high ground. On the 10th day he was resting in the deep shade at the edge of a clearing of golden grass, when he had his first good sighting of larger game. A small herd of graceful pale brown impala, led by 3 impressively horned rams, emerged from the far side of the clearing. They fed cautiously. Every few seconds they froze into perfect stillness, with only the big scoop-like ears moving as they listened for danger, and their wet black noses snuffing silently. Mark was out of meat. He had eaten the last of the bully the previous day, and he had brought the rifle for just this moment, to relieve a diet of mealy porridge. Yet he found himself strangely reluctant to use it now, a reluctance he had never known as a boy. For the first time, he looked with eyes that saw not just meat, but rare and unusual beauty. The 3 rams moved slowly across the clearing, passing 100 paces from where Mark sat silently, and then drifted away, pale shadows into the thorn scrub. The does followed them, trotting to keep up, one with a lamb stumbling on long gawky legs at her flank, and at the rear of the troop was a half-grown doe. One of her back legs was crippled. It was withered and stunted, swinging free of the ground, and the animal was having difficulty keeping up with the herd. It had lost condition badly. Bone of rib and spine showed clearly through a hide that lacked the gloss and shine of health. Mark swung up the P-14, and the flat crack of the shot bounced from the cliffs across the river and startled a flock of white-faced duck into whistling flight off the river. Mark stooped over the doe as she lay in the grass and touched the long curled lashes that fringed the dark swimming eye. There was no reflex blink, and the check for life was routine only. He knew the shot had taken her in the centre of the heart, an instantaneous kill. "Always make the check," the old man's teachings again. "Percy Young would tell you that himself if he could. But he was sitting there on a dead lion he'd just shot, having a quiet pipe when it came to life again. That's why he isn't around to tell you himself." Mark rolled the carcass and squatted to examine the back limb. The wire noose had cut through the skin, through sinew and flesh, and had come up hard against the bone as the animal struggled to break out of the snare. Below the wire, the leg had gangrened, and the smell was nauseous, summoning a black, moving wad of flies. Mark made the shallow gutting stroke, deflecting the blade upwards to avoid puncturing the gut. The belly opened like a purse. He freed the anus and vagina with the deft surgeon strokes and lifted out bladder and bowel and gut in one scoop. He dissected the purple liver out of the mass of viscera, cut away the gallbladder and tossed it aside. Grilled over the coals, the liver would make a feast for his dinner. He cut away the rotten, stinking hind leg, and then he carefully wiped out the stomach cavity with a handful of dry grass. He cut flaps in the skin of the neck. Using the flaps of skin as handles, he hefted the whole carcass and lugged it down to the camp by the river. Cut and salted and dried, he now had meat for the rest of his stay. He hung the strips of meat high in the sycamore fig to save them from the scavengers who would surely visit the camp during his daily absences, and only when he had finished the task and he was crouching over his fire with a steaming mug in his hand did he think again of the snaring wire that had crippled the impala doe. He felt an indirect flash of anger at the person who had set that noose, and then almost immediately he wondered why he should feel particular anger at the trapper, when a dozen times he had come across the old abandoned camps of white hunters. Always there were the bones, and the piles of rotting, worm-riddled horns. The trapper was clearly a black man, and his need was greater than that of the others who came in to butcher and dry and sell. Thinking about it, Mark felt a despondency slowly overwhelm him. Even in the few short years since he had first visited this wilderness, the game had been reduced to but a small fraction of its original numbers. Soon it would all be gone. As the old man had said, the great emptiness is coming. Mark sat at his fireside, and he felt deeply saddened at the inevitable. No creature would ever be allowed to compete with man, and he remembered the old man again. Some say the lion, others the leopard. But believe me, my boy, when a man looks in the mirror, he sees the most dangerous and merciless killer in all of nature. The pit had been built to resemble a sunken water reservoir. It was 50 feet across and 10 feet deep, perfectly circular, plastered and floored in smooth cement. Although there were water pipes installed and its position on the first slope of the escarpment above Ladyburg was perfectly chosen to provide the correct fall to the big gabled house below, yet it had never held water. The circular walls were whitewashed to gleaming purity, and the floor was lightly spread with clean-washed river sand and neatly raked. Pine trees had been planted to screen the reservoir. A 12-stranded barbed wire fence enclosed the whole plantation, and there were two guards at the gate this evening, tough, silent men who checked the guests as the cars brought them up from the big house. There were 48 men and women in the excited, laughing stream that followed through the gate, and followed the path up among the pines to where the pit was already starkly lit by the brilliant glare of the Petromax lanterns suspended on poles above it. Dirk Courtney led the revellers. He wore black gabardine riding breeches and polished knee-length boots to protect his legs from slashing fangs. And his white linen shirt was open almost to the navel, exposing the hard, bulging muscle of his chest and the coarse black body hair which curled from the V of the neck. The sleeves of the shirt were cut full to the wrist, and he rolled a long, thin cheroot from one corner of his mouth to the other without touching it. For his arms were around the waists of the women who flanked him, young women with bold eyes and laughing, painted mouths. The dogs heard them coming and bayed at them, leaping against the padded bars of their cages, hysterical with excitement as they tried to reach each other through the gaps, snarling and snapping and slavering while the handlers attempted to shut them into silence. The spectators lined the circular parapet of the pit, hanging over the edge. In the merciless light of the Petromax, the faces were laid bare, every emotion, every stark detail of the bloodlust and sadistic anticipation was revealed. The hectic colouring of the women's cheeks, the feverish glitter of the men's eyes, the shrillness of their laughter, and the widely exaggerated gesturing. During the early bouts, the small dark-haired girl beside Dirk screamed and wriggled, holding her clenched fists to her open mouth, moaning and gasping with fascinated, delighted horror. Once she turned and buried her face against Dirk's chest, pressing her body trembling and shuddering against him. Dirk laughed and held her around the waist. At the kill, she screamed with the rest of them, and her back arched. Then Dirk half lifted her, as she sobbed breathlessly, and supported her to the refreshment table, where there was champagne in silver buckets, and sandwiches of brown bread and smoked salmon. Charles came to where Dirk sat with the girl on his lap, feeding her champagne from a crystal glass, surrounded by a dozen of his sycophants, jovial and expansive, enjoying the rising sense of tension for the final bout of the evening, when he would match his own dog, Charker, against Charles's animal. "I feel bad, Dirk," Charles told him. "They've just told me that your dog is giving almost 10 pounds. "That mongrel of yours will need every pound, Charles. Don't feel bad now. Keep it for later, when you'll really need it." Dirk was suddenly bored with the girl, and he pushed her casually from his lap, so that she almost lost her balance and fell. Piqued, she settled her skirts, pouted at Dirk, and when she realized he'd already forgotten her existence, she flounced away. "Here," Dirk indicated the chair beside him. "Do have a seat, Charles, old boy, and let's discuss your problem." The crowd drew closer around them, listening eagerly to their banter, and braying slavishly at each sally. "My problem is that I should like a small wager on the bout, but it does seem most unsporting to bet against a light dog like yours." Charles grinned, as he mopped his streaming red face with a silk handkerchief, sweating heavily with champagne and excitement and the closeness of the humid summer evening. "We all know that you make your living betting on certainties." Charles was a stockbroker from the Witwatersrand. "However, the expression of such noble sentiment does you great credit." Dirk tapped his shoulder with the hilt of his dog whip, a familiar, condescending gesture that made Charles's grin tighten wolfishly. "You will accommodate me, then?" he asked, nodding and winking at his own henchmen in the press of listening men. "At even money?" "Of course, as much as you want." "My dog, Kaiser, against your Charker to the death. Even money, a wager of..." Charles paused and looked to the ladies, smoothing the crisp little moustache with its lacing of iron grey, drawing out the moment. "£1,000 in gold." The crowd gasped and exclaimed, and some of the listeners applauded, a smattering of hand claps. "No, no," Dirk Courtney held up both hands in protest. "Not 1,000? And the listeners groaned, his own clack shocked and crestfallen at the loss of prestige. "Oh dear," Charles murmured, "too strong for your blood, huh? Well, name the wager then, old boy." "Let's have some real interest. Say, 10,000 in gold." Dirk tapped Charles's shoulder again, and the man's grin froze over. The colour faded from the scarlet face, leaving it blotched purple and puffy white. The small acquisitive eyes darted quickly around the circle of laughing, applauding faces, as if seeking an escape, and then slowly, reluctantly, returned to Dirk's face. He tried to say something, but his voice squeaked and broke like a pubescent boy. "And what exactly does that mean?" Dirk inquired with elaborate politeness. Charles would not trust his voice again, but he nodded jerkily and tried to resurrect his cheeky grin, but it was crooked and tense and hung awkwardly on his face.